Artorama Podcast.
So, hi Olivier. Thank you very much for your time doing this Artorama Podcast.
Hey Thiago, great speaking to you from Brussels to Brazil. That's nice. Super nice.
That's nice. So let's start by the first question that actually it's concerning the beginning, your beginning as a collector. That it's funny that you mentioned Brazil because you were here in Brazil, you traveled a lot, and you were in a lot of cocktails and receptions that you mentioned to me before that in these occasions there were exhibitions and I think that was the beginning. That was the way that you got in touch with art, you know. And I'm not sure how was this. So if you can talk a little bit about this beginning and how did this first contact with art change throughout the time.
Yeah, it all started to work in September, and then as a business analyst in a commodity company, quite involved in Brazil. Yeah, you're right. And quite quickly, I was invited by banks for, you know, cocktails and dinners and parties. And many of those banks had, and it was the case of BBL, which is now ING. They have a curator and they have their own exhibitions and their own collections. And then one of the first cocktails I went in Brussels in BBL was, it was a Friday evening, and the exhibition was the US minimalist artist, Carl André, Donald Judd. And actually in those kind of cocktails, you don't pay attention. Nobody pays attention to the works, because quickly after there is a dinner and there is drinks. But for me, I was really stuck, actually. I didn't know what I was looking at. I didn't know it was art. Why was it art? How could that be art? And 1 month later, I had another cocktail in the same bank, and it was the Carlos Soto works, the Penetrable from Carlos Soto. And again, it was a second shock for me. And then that's how I started to be interested in that, because for me, even if my parents were visiting exhibitions and everything, but it was more Monet, Van Gogh and Degas. Then for me, art was Monet, Van Gogh, Degas paintings and sculptures and blah, blah, blah. Then to see that was really a big shock. Yeah, really a big shock, huge shock, actually. Yeah. And then I was traveling a lot quite quickly in the company. And then every time I started to visit galleries, museums, discovering a new world that I didn't know. And then every time I had a spare time, like an afternoon, I was escaped 3 hours to go to visit museums. Actually, not everywhere in the world, but well, in the US, South Africa, France, Brazil. And it was really, yeah, it was shock on shock, actually. I really discovered something. Then back in Brussels, I was able to visit galleries, and that's really how I started to be involved in that before acquiring any work. Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. And in the course of this time, you learned, I imagine you learned a great deal. And you mentioned to me that you, during this process, you read a lot of things. You had like this reading material, and that was crucial and important for you. And you asked a lot of questions to different galleries during this path, you know, during this journey. Did you learn through other ways? I mean, about art. And do you want to talk more about these two elements, you know, about how galleries maybe helped you to understand art, and how these readings helps you as well?
Yeah, those two elements were really the key ones. And that's one when visiting fairs and discussing with them. At that time, I had no access to the artist directly, as I have now, which is another process. But at that time, it was mainly discussing with the galleries, asking questions about the work, about the artist. Again, why is it art? What does he say? Why the artist did that? Even for very aesthetic works, I wanted to understand. And some stuff you cannot explain, but still, I'm quite rational. Then it was also a way for me to escape that maybe. Then it was really a mix of asking questions, visiting more and more. In museum, you don't ask questions the same way, but then it allows you to read the monographic catalog when there is one, and reading books. Well, I was reading maybe not books of theory of art. I have no training or formation in art, but then I'm not that much interested in the theory itself. But the monography, for instance, yeah, that was something I was really interested in, to read the past of the artist, what he was trying to do, interview with the artist were quite interesting also. Then it's maybe a mix of three things, asking questions to galleries, visiting a lot, really a lot, and reading those catalogs and books. And it's that mix of the three things, who helped me. I also attended some conferences and some lectures in Brussels. I remember it was on the Monday evening from 6 to 8. Then I was trying to arrange my trips and according to that, then I could not miss one. It's not always easy, but it's a mix of all those things.
That's great, and I think it was during this time frame of 1995 and 2014, no, which is important for you, and is a period that during when you bought a lot of small works that you mentioned, doing fairs and galleries, and the more you advanced, the more you approach immateriality. Could you tell us more about this transition? I mean, from the object to the immateriality. But at the same time, you told me as well that you always need an object. So it's a transition with this, but, this condition, right?
Yeah, but actually, it's true that between 1995 and 2014, which is almost 20 years actually, I bought a lot of small piece. Well, salaries, when you do a career in a company, your salary is also increasing. Then the pieces which are small at the beginning become sometimes a bit more important. But well, it's true that now retrospectively there are many pieces I would not buy anymore because I really bought a lot, sometimes really by good girl or quickly. But I think that every acquisition was a step, a learning process as well, maybe like I did in the same time by questioning or reading. And I'm still quite happy to rediscover some of them. They are wrapped. I have a small storage and I'm still happy to rediscover them. But I would not acquire them anymore. And then there were some important steps and more important acquisitions, like I think about Nan Goldin, I discovered another new world. Robin Hood, because I was in South Africa, Hans of the Beek. And then step by step, first the accumulation of more small works. So, you start to hesitate and you say, there is someone else who did more or less the same, but it's better. And then the more you advance and the more you become maybe demanding as well. And then the more I was advancing, actually, the more the content of the work, the process of the artist, the link with the world, the link with the relationships became really key and important. And then quite naturally, I started to approach more and more immaterial works or invisible or immaterial works because I was focusing on that process and content. And then the question raised, the doubt, new things to learn, and then the work itself, and that's where the paradox is, you're right, the work itself is maybe sometimes less important than all what's going through to arrive at the work. But there is a paradox that I need a trace. It's true that I need an object. I need a trace. I need something which allows me to share with the others, and to discuss, to share. And it reminds me of a Belgian collector. I don't know if you know him, Herman Daled, who is quite old now. It's almost 90, or maybe he's 90. And he was saying one day that for him, well, the works were not shown in the house. Everything was in storage or on the blankets and bags, and completely amazing. But for him, to show a piece of art was like pulling out a vinyl out of his sleeves and sharing the vinyl, the content of the vinyl, with someone. And for me, there is something from that with art as well. That's why I go more and more to immateriality since 5 years, maybe. But I still need an object, yeah. I still need, when we touch, in the house, the pieces are shown, we touch them, we share them, even when the kids are very young, then they know they cannot touch, but when people are there, I don't hesitate to take the piece, to show it, to discuss, which really allow, for me, it's where the link between art and life is, that's where it touch, and there is that... That area, that everything is possible there. Yeah,
that's beautiful, because you were mentioning life, and I remember that you had a big change in your life. The company you were in got really big, and you did something different. And I was wondering if you could talk about this. How does it change your relation with art? You know, this moment, this crucial change. You know.
Yeah, that moment was very important. It's 2013-14, it took 1 year and a half almost. The company became quite big. I was shareholder in the company, so the CFO of the company, of the group worldwide, and still traveling a lot. And then there is one step that you say, okay, where does it go? I can become richer, and then I buy a house everywhere in the world. I don't know, in Búzios, so in Saint-Tropez or in Verbier, or you can decide to do something else. And then I met my wife, and at that time we went walking for 3 months, backpacking from Brussels to Rome, to the Via Francigena, discussing a lot. She was traveling in London. And then I decided to sell my shares, to quit the company, to concentrate on more social business. I was already involved in some favelas in Rio de Janeiro with some social projects and in South Africa as well. But still, that's something I wanted to concentrate on. And for me, it was directly, art was linked to that automatically. Then art has always been linked to what was going on in my life. And now I'm involved with social microcredit, circular economy, alternative agricultural process and practices, and art and the collection now since 5 or 6 years. And then I opened. For me, art, yeah, had to cope with that new things I was living. We made 3 kids in 5 years or 6 years. Which is also something. And then I became very demanding toward art, actually. Exhibitions, acquisition, galleries, very demanding. My relation with art and acquisition and the collection became almost very professional. It was not a hobby anymore. It was something serious, deep, not a distraction at all. Still with pleasure, sometimes even not, but still with pleasure, but with a strong focus, attention, and concentration. Yeah, there was really a shift in 13, 14. Yeah.
For sure, and there is, I think, this moment that you mentioned that you need content from the work, and I remembered that you told me about the rhizomatic content that emerged from the artist, that there is no epiphany there, you know? There is always a relationship with someone and with time. And this actually did lead you to create this space that I think it would be amazing if you could talk a little bit about it right now.
Yeah, the content. Yeah, the rhizomatic and the rhizomatic aspect is very important because for me, art is really a mean and a way to access things that I don't know. It's a way to access and to communicate with the world, our world today. It's a way to be touched, questioned, to have doubts, to be disturbed, to be assaulted, repulsed, even attracted. And then starting from there, it means that it's not an epiphany at all because it's linked to the real world. Then it's linked to economical aspects, books, theater, dance, all those things, which is our life, actually. And when I discussed that deeply with some galleries, I had the impression that, well, they do a crazy job, so difficult, and they are so busy with the next exhibition, the next fair, running all over the world. Then I was not very satisfied with the answers I get or even with the discussion I had with them. And then I did something quite simple. I decided to create my own art space. And we had the opportunity to do that close to the house, which something very easy on my side. I decided that I will not be involved with the sales, which is the stressing aspect of it. And then it's a purely philanthropic. Then it's kind of not weak on my side, but it's a way of escaping at least that pressure. Then it's a purely philanthropic space. I decided to allocate part of the budget of the acquisition, because I try to work with a budget, even if it doesn't work always. But for the acquisition, then I decided to reallocate part of that budget to the space. And it's really a non-profit space, philanthropic. We organize 2 to 3 exhibitions of 5 weeks per year with artists, known or unknown. We finance them, we finance the production, and we also invite once per year unknown private collectors. At the time of the Art Brussels Fair, it's part of the VIP visits and everything. But I try to find really unknown collectors with normal financial means, then not collectors which are known in the sector. It's always very nice. And again, it's where art meets life.
That's beautiful.
That was a big move. Yeah.
And really necessary for the sector as well. And I was wondering if we could maybe move and talk a little bit about how is the relation of invisibility with your collection?
Well, my I'm not a collector of protocols, for instance. I need an object. Then I don't have invisible works, even if I have works that I cannot show, because the artists did it like that. I have works which are performance. I have works which are a long process. I have a few works which are 1 year, 1.5 years of process. And at the end, there is just a small thing, a small PowerPoint or a small thing. And that's really the works that I like, because there is that trace and testimony of that long process. There is still something material. It's not invisible, and I can still a USB key that you can leave on the table and someone will ask what it is, and actually it contains 12 months of work with an artist who went to interview people in the street and all those things. And it's a little bit like a book, a play, or a theater or something. Then it's a memory, but as we said, I need an object. The important thing is that it's opening new horizons, new questions, new horizons. We live with the works, that's for sure. And there are always, 5 or 10% exceptions. And I still buy some good curves sometimes, or some very aesthetic works as well, because you are touched, and art is also that. And the works are also more and more complex. And that's maybe linked to the space I'm running now since 6 years already. The works are more complex. They are more complex to apprehend, more complex to explain as well. There are more and more videos now. It's really changing in that way. More complex. More testimony of the process, in a way. Yeah.
I see. Let's talk a little bit about the specific works. For example, Adrian Luca, I think, has the lights itself. You know, the way that his practice unfolds is, it's on the realm of invisibility. I imagine. No, you want to talk about specific?
Yeah. Adrian Luca is really interesting because we show. Well, I knew him from before, but I invited him in the space, and he's working on light and color, and then almost in a scientific way. But he's still an artist as well. He's a teacher of colors in one of the art school here in Brussels. Then it's not really science, but it's something completely amazing. It's almost the third dimension that we don't know. That's how we perceive colors, how it affects, how colors is affecting and changing objects or perception of objects. But what he said was really interesting. At the end, also for him, even if he's working with invisibility, because that light is invisible, it's white color changing the color of an object which is red or orange, or he said that at the end it has to be something very plastic also. So some is plastic, and then something also, there is an object at the end, and that's where it's really interesting, to because there is something shamanic also, huh? It's I don't know, my wife told him one day that the next step is talking with God, because what he does is really and he said, yeah, maybe there's something from that. Then on a way, on a side, it's very material, because those lights he's developing are really a long process, and it's really you cannot see, and there is an object, an effect on an object, and then it's invisible and visible in the same time. It's really super. Yeah.
That's beautiful. And could you mention other artists of the collection that maybe are focused on invisibility?
Yeah, there is one which is, I learned in two ways, and there is one by Eva Varto and Yann Serrandou, for instance. It's a piece that I'm not allowed to show, exactly what I'm allowed to show, but it's a strange piece. It's a black envelope made of plastic, and inside there is something, a piece of work, and actually they took part and they attended an auction which was about gambling, playing and gambling, and they got seven small lithographies from the 90s or 18th century. Not those small lithography are put in those envelopes, except that in one of the seven envelopes that you are buying, they replaced it by one of their work, Eva Barto and Yann Serrandou. But when you buy one, because you only buy one, and seven collectors both each one, you don't know what is inside, and then you receive a certificate after, which is the abstract of the auction catalog, saying that what you are supposed to have inside you cannot open, and you have to put it in a storage somewhere, or in your bookshelves or somewhere. And when it's shown in an exhibition, there is just a small cartel saying that the piece is somewhere, and it can be shown on request. Then the piece is there, not visible inside of the envelope. It's not visible neither, and still it's very strong on the way of a collector is behaving, like you are buying something, you don't know what you buy, you don't know what is inside. Maybe Eva Barto and Yann Serrandou in 100 years will be big stars, and then you have one of their work in the envelope, but maybe not. And then all those things, all that relationship is really, that's something nice. And there is another one that I really like a lot. I have two others, actually. One is linked directly to Eva Barto's work. It's Beatrice Balcou, who made, she's doing those ceremony, like a tea ceremony with the artwork, like unwrapping for a small audience of 20 people. There is all a process, and then she's unwrapping the piece, showing it to the audience, and then wrapping it again. And she did it with that work of Eva Barto, which she was not supposed to show. And then there was an exchange of emails and phone calls between Beatrice Balcou, Eva Barto, Yann Serrandou. I learned a lot on the piece also. Well, it was really super. It was a big success here in the art space.
And the last one to finish up the
last, and the last Yeah, the last one is explaining quite well what I'm interested in as well. It's Joséphine Caplin, who's a French artist, that I asked her to do an audit, like a professional. You know, you have KPMG, Ernst & Young, Roland Berger, I don't know, those big consulting companies doing audit of a business. And I came from that business world. And then I asked her to do to perform an audit of the art space, which is really a small art space in Brussels. It's run by my wife and I. Well, we have many visitors, but we are not Le Louvre or Pompidou. And then she, I gave a remuneration to her on a monthly basis, like a consultant. She was coming every month here for 2 hours of interview with small games, jeu de rôle, like we do in business and everything. And it was a 1.5 year process. And at the end, and we had a contract together. And at the end, I was supposed to receive a report of an audit of ET78. How does it work? Are the people happy? There was even a questionnaire addressed to 100 visitors, and 80 of them answered on a very confidential basis to her. And serious question, but always with a décalage, always with something beside. And at the end, the final work is just a PowerPoint. And we did a closing meeting, as we call it, and it was fully booked. And we booked for 20 people around a big board meeting table that she brought in the space. And it was our last exchange, which was public. And then there were only 20 people. We could not do it twice because it was the closing meeting that she gave me the official documents that I cannot open, with all the questionnaires, all the people, but they are confidential. Then I cannot open them. And there is that PowerPoint, like in the business life, you have those, well, maybe it's a bit less now, but, and that's why, again, it's a long process and it says a lot about many things. It involves many people and it's also a way of sharing and questioning all those ways of working, yeah.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you very much, Olivier. It was wonderful talking to you, and thank you very much for making your collection visible to us.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's well done. Thank you, Thiago.
Thanks.
Artorama Podcast.